This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge. Joanne and Dave talk with members of the Passion Art and Abel Gordley Healing Center about A Sunbeam, a play that links theater and healing.
That document cannot meaningfully be described without revealing classified information.
The Bush administration hid behind the state secrets privilege to spy on the American people. President Obama promised change, but recent court battles suggest the threats to our civil liberties will continue. Will the Obama administration continue to use the privilege of the presidency to hide unconstitutional actions from the public? We the People talked to Portland attorney Tom Nelson earlier this week to discuss how a local case of illegal spying could shed some light on the future of government surveillance on Americans. Join us this Thursday evening at 6, when We the People will take your calls to explore these questions and discuss your concerns. Listen and tell us what you think. We the People, last Thursday at 6 p.m., www.kboo.fm/we the people.
KBOO is proud to host A Conversation with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, on Saturday, April 11th at the Baghdad Theater. This event is a benefit for KBOO Community Radio. KBOO's own Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza, hosts of Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, will interview Amy on stage. She will talk about her book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, and her experiences as an award-winning journalist. That's A Conversation with Amy Goodman benefit for KBOO on April 11th at noon at the Baghdad Theater in Southeast Portland. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm or by phone at 503-231-8032.
Good morning. This is Dave Mazza.
And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you're listening to Voices from the Edge. And I'm losing my voice here. I am on the edge. Well, this morning we have an interesting show for you. You know, theater's always been a sort of mirror for folks to be able to reflect on things that would be too difficult to stare at in the stark reality of. And we're going to talk about a production that's coming up, opening up next week at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center that takes this a step further in terms of linking theater with a healing process. And so this morning we have quite a group here. They're members of Passion Art, the production company that's putting on A Sunbeam, which is a play by John Henry Redwood. And we also have a member of the Abel Gordley Healing Center to talk about what the play is about, what these talkback sessions are going to be about, and just also the role of theater in how we address these sorts of problems that we face every day. And we got a roll call going here. So first of all, we have Trish Egan, who is the director at Passion Art of this production. We also have Kenneth Dembo, who plays the role of Saul in A Sunbeam. We have Jerry Foster, who's the artistic director at Passion Art. And we have Danette C. Birchall, who is the clinical associate director of the Abel Gordley Center for Healing. And we want to thank you all for being here this morning.
Good to be here.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
And as always, we want you to join us in the conversation by giving us a call at 503-231-8187. Well, probably to put this in some sort of framework for our listeners, why don't we start, Trish, with maybe giving us just a quick thumbnail sketch of what the play is about.
Well, we have a family of three
husband, wife, and son. The parents of the family are having some difficulties in their relationship and in lots of ways as regards their relationship with the son. And the ways that they do or don't deal with those issues and try and find ways to come to some sort of better conclusion about how they all interact is really the basis of the play.
And let's kind of move over then to Danette, and if you would talk a little bit about how Abel Gordon Healing Center fits into this picture. You folks are not normally going up on stage.
Absolutely. The Abel Gordon Center for Healing is a multicultural adult outpatient mental health and addictions treatment facility. Center, and the play in particular is representing an African-American family, and along with our multicultural focus, we specifically have services for African and African-American clients as a sub-program of the whole. And within that program, we have 5 African-American licensed mental health practitioners, including our psychiatrist, which is our medical director, Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson. Dr. Garfield DeBartolaban is our clinical psychologist. And then myself, I am an African-American licensed clinical social worker. And also Carol Chisholm and Andre Pruitt are also African-American licensed clinical social workers. And we are available for individual, couple, family, and group therapy at the center. And we, in pairs of us, will be facilitating talkbacks after the play to address issues of mental health and mental wellness in the African-American community.
And so it's a big deal that we actually have the Avell Gordley Center for Healing in downtown Portland. It's only been in operation for a little over a year, is that right?
That's right.
And it was huge because, of course, we had lost most culturally specific mental health services through all the state budget cutbacks. Mm-hmm. And so, and I love the fact that it's named after the first African American woman in the legislative body. And so, can you tell us a little bit about the history, like why the center exists and the significance of it being downtown and just a little bit more? Because I don't think that the listening audience may know enough about where it is and why it is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Joanne. Thank you. The Avell Gordley Center for Healing was a project by Senator Avell Gordley, Senator Margaret Carter, and the African American Mental Health Commission that's been worked on for a number of years, 8 or 9 years in the making, until they actually secured funding to begin the Center for Culturally Specific Services for African and African American members of the community, mostly in the Portland metropolitan area, but of course we could serve people statewide if they had access, right, to the facility. And the reason that this is such a critical component, and we are not the only culturally specific providers in the Portland metropolitan area. I want to acknowledge LifeWorks Northwest and Cascadia, Central City Concern. There are other culturally specific African American programs in the region. And the Intercultural Psychiatric Program also serves African clients, and that's part of OHSU. And we are a part of OHSU, by the way. We are in the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU. And so, but this project was so fundamental because what we have found that in the African American community, we are underrepresented in involuntary mental health and addiction services, whereas we are overrepresented in involuntary or mandated services through the criminal justice system or through DHS. And so we are trying to afford an opportunity for African and African Americans to seek services from providers that look like them, which is a huge issue for our community because of the historical implications of us being in the country with slavery and racism, and how the medical establishment has traditionally treated African Americans with bias, and there's a lack of trust. And in our culture, putting your business in the street is not an acceptable thing to do, and people become very afraid for their confidentiality, and there is also a lot of stigma around mental health and mental illness, to the point where a person may only seek services if they're being considered crazy. And we're trying to reduce that stigma and let people know that there are many concerns that they might be experiencing that would benefit from mental health treatment, and that you don't have to be crazy. And you're not crazy for wanting to seek some help for depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other concerns such as substance abuse. And even we also offer gambling treatment. So that's a little bit of information regarding
the location.
The location. We are located at 621 Southwest Alder in Suite 520. And the choice of the location, it's a very strategic choice. There were questions about why isn't it located in North Portland or Northeast Portland. Well, the African American community has been dispersed.
That's right.
And is no longer fully centralized to North and Northeast Portland. There's also an additional element of confidentiality. The building we're located in is downtown. It's in a 9-story building. There's no reception in the front lobby. Mm-hmm. There's not a reception until you actually come to the 5th floor. So when you enter the building, nobody knows what you're entering the building for.
Right.
It's also conveniently located on bus lines and MAX lines for people in the community that are living out east in Gresham and Troutdale, or out west in Beaverton, out to Hillsboro. It's a centralized location where people can come for to a building that's very nondescript and non-threatening. So that's part of the choice of the location. Also, the services were added to an existing clinic of OHSU, formerly known as the Behavioral Health Clinic. And this clinic has a long-standing history as being one of the oldest alcohol and drug programs on the West Coast, and has been around for many, many years. So it already had infrastructure available and a full staff and programming available prior to the recruitment of African-American practitioners to provide this program.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And excuse me again. You're listening to Voices from the Edge. We're talking this morning with members of Pass and Art, who are putting on a production of A Sunbeam at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, as well as with Danette Burchill of the Abel Gordley Healing Center, or Center for Healing, excuse me. We're talking about this new production, which combines theater with outreach to deal with how to better deal with some of the problems that the play deals with, domestic problems and
family problems,
emotional problems. And, you know, Kenneth, as an actor, what did this facet mean to you, and, you know, how did it affect your performance, and how do you feel about just kind of expanding this role of theater in general?
I'm very proud to be able to put this production on and to be a part of it. This is actually a reprieve of a role for me. This is the second time that I'm going to be doing it. So I am just so honored to be able to do this again, and especially in the times that we're kind of living in now with the economic issues that are going on, because this play or this production is going to focus on so many aspects of what's going on right now, because we are setting it in today's time.
Right.
So not only are they dealing with the mental and the physical issues, but there's an economic issue also. So I think it's really, really timely that we were able to partner with this organization here to bring some of those issues to the forefront.
And whose idea was it to actually partner a service component along with a theater component, right? Because most of the time people go to the theater, they think, okay, entertain me, right? I put down my money, entertain me. But this seems to be like just a incredible brainstorm. So whose idea was it that, you know, this was a good opportunity to really make sure that we were partnering these two efforts so that people knew that there was something that could happen afterwards? Is that the director, the creative director?
No, that matter of fact, that's part of our mission, which is to entertain, educate, and inspire artists, and also while addressing the critical issues that are facing our community.
Wonderful.
And one of our values is to provide a forum for artists and community members to connect through the medium of theater as a catalyst for community dialogue regarding those issues that impact not only African American community but also multicultural groups. And matter of fact, this is a second collaboration that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
We, like Kenneth was saying before, we've done this play before, and one of the biggest issues is, where do people go get the service? That was one of the biggest questions from me. Where do people go to get the service? Who do they talk to? How can they connect with that? And so as we were looking to do this again, and the reason why we're doing this again, because the playwright John Henry Redwood was one of our mentors. He was the one that really got the ball rolling for us, and he passed away. And so we were doing it in memory of him.
Wonderful.
And so when we thought about doing it again, we said, how can we better serve the community? What resources can we pull out? And Connie Carley, who's one of the founding members of Passing Art, got to thinking about it, and she remembered the Abel Gordley Center, and we kind of tossed it back and forth around the boardroom and said, well, you know, let's see how we can make this work.
Well, that explains, I ran into Connie at Costco, and she was like, I'm so glad that you're having Passing Art on the show. So that's the connection. Okay, I was like, oh, how did you know that?
Connie and I had a great conversation early on in this process about how we felt that there were some issues that could be really beautifully examined about the willingness or the caution with which everybody, but in this particular instance, African Americans are a little bit hesitant to approach mental health services because of the community stigma.
Right.
And it was an exciting discussion from the very beginning when we realized that we both felt strongly about the same issue, and that it was a really wonderful opportunity to be able to bring in professionals who could address these issues and to put materials in the lobby at the show and that sort of thing, where we can let people know that there are services available and they are available in a way that keeps them from feeling like they're being made a spectacle of and that sort of thing. So we're delighted to be able to make that partnership.
And it goes without saying, I know Senator Avell Gordley has been very consistent in sharing the news about what happened with her son and the fact that her son was almost killed by Portland police. And just fortunately, Derek Foxworth was at the scene and was able to mitigate what could have been a very, very tragic situation,
mm-hmm.
and all related back to mental illness and mental health issues and not being able to get treatment when you needed it from a provider of your choice. And so this is certainly a really profound issue that has so many layers in our community, because, of course, we end up using the police as the mental health service provider. I think we can all agree that they are not the best qualified people to be providing mental health services in our community.
Indeed.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Passing Art, the Sunbeam, actually fits into sort of the larger mission of Passing Art. What other sorts of productions have you done that are related in this way?
Wow, we've done a play that was called
Deceptive Love.
Sorry, it's early.
And we don't provide coffee. I know.
And one of the things about Deceptive Love is that it talked about the issues of AIDS, which, you know, as in the black community, is not a subject that we so openly talk about. But we wanted to do that particular play to provide, again, another platform for which to have some discussion so people can open up about, you know, about those issues.
Mm-hmm.
We did a piece called Lullaby,
mm-hmm.
which dealt with mothers not letting go of their sons, even though their sons are grown.
Or
vice versa, not letting go of their mothers, too, you know.
Don't leave home, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Well, if mothers weren't like that, sons would live to be left alone.
We need some counseling here, please.
And so that, again, that kind of shed a light on that particular issue. We did a piece called the Pews, which talked about ministers in the church, and we did get some feedback from that, but it was just to entertain and just to put those issues out there. That's, and it's right. Up to the people to just make a decision on whether they want to discuss that or not. And we did Flying West, which talked about women migrating to the West, which is something that no one really talked about. You know, there are more women that moved that didn't have husbands who had to pull up together as a family. And they weren't, even though they weren't related in one sense, but that extended family became very strong. We did Voices from the Kitchen, which focused on women who were the silent heroes of the civil rights movement, women that worked in those kitchens that heard what was going on as they was out there serving. You know, so, you know, it just continued to provide in that aspect something for people to talk about and to shed a light on history, too, as we do it. We did Portraits in Black, which we took and we focused on six historical figures, and one was a local historical figure, Johnny Jackson, who was a pastor at one time at Mount Olivet.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so we took all of that and invited the public in and put that information out there again so that it can spur some discussion. Mm-hmm. So that's what it's about.
Wow, it sounds like you guys have been doing that for quite a while. And so for a Sunbeam, it starts April 2nd through April 25th. And there's a website, passingart.net, that you can go to and get lots of information. And people can also get tickets at Reflection Coffee and Talking Drum Bookstore. Let's see, and I remember you were telling me just before we went on the air that on the 2nd, April 2nd, will be Community Night.
That is correct.
And Community Night gives the community, people who normally don't have the opportunity to actually go to see live theater, an opportunity to receive a reduced fee ticket. And so they can go to the website and get more information about that?
They can go to the website, and they can also call us at 503-321-5163. And basically, just all those tickets will be available at the door.
At the door,
at
okay.
the door, yes.
Now, and so do we want to announce that?
Well, we probably should.
Yeah, so we're going to find out how awake our listening audience is this morning, because a Sunbeam production is going to allow us to give away six tickets this morning, and Dave and I have to think of like brilliant questions that you have to answer in order to qualify for those free tickets. And those tickets will be able to be used any night other than opening night. All we'll have to do is give your name to the Passing Art company, and they will have those tickets available for you. And there will only be one ticket per person, so please don't assume you're going to call and get all six.
Unless you've got a really smart family that can all call in. You know, one of the things I'm curious about is, and Trish or Jerry, I'd like to hear your take on this, is you're doing theater that's obviously rooted in reaching out to the community, but what challenges is theater facing with all the other noise going on? Because you're competing with television, you're competing with radio.
so sorry.
And, you know, all the variety of other media. And is it making it more difficult to, you know, get the audiences you really want to reach?
Absolutely. There wasn't ever adequate or huge support from the state or from private business concerns and that sort of thing. It's one of the forms of the arts in the country that isn't very well supported in that way. And we depend largely on ticket sales in order to be able to keep the doors open and the actors on the stage. So it's been really important for us to try and find ways to choose productions that inspire our audience members to pass the art along mm-hmm. to other people in their family and to friends and coworkers and that sort of thing. And we found in the first production of this show that there were many, many people who came back multiple times and each mm-hmm. time bringing a different group of friends and family. And that it is really something that's it's a gift to be able to share with the people that you love. And so we're grateful to have such a strong work to be able to do that with.
And Danette, it sounds like you have a comment you want to make here.
Yes, I just realized that I never gave the phone number scheduling an appointment for mm-hmm. the Avail Gordley Center for Healing, which I thought might be really important to mm-hmm. get out to everyone. So the way the process works is that if somebody's interested in the services, they do an initial phone call to 503-418-5311. That's 503-418-5311. Mm-hmm. And they speak with our intake coordinator, who will ask them a series of questions about their concerns, insurance information, or payment information. We do offer some service on a sliding scale fee that goes down to zero, and we accept all commercial insurances, and we can work with most situations. So I just wanted to let people know about how they can access the services in case they're interested.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we did forget that, and we also forgot to tell people they could give us a call at 503. What is the number? 503-231-8187.
Well, if they call us, we have to give them those tickets.
That's true. Yeah. You were and we're trying to hold on to them. Like, we're trying to hold on. We got friends that need to see this play. No, just kidding. We would be happy to give it to our listening audience as soon as Dave and I think of some compelling questions to have you answer. And actually, I know exactly what the first question would be.
Go for it, Joanne.
Well, the first question would be, so if you go to see the Sunbeam, what is the service provider that will be in the audience to assist you in actually processing this information at the end of the show?
Ooh.
Tough
checking,
question.
Checking yeah. listening skills.
Ding, 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 ding,
so
ding.
Give us a call on that.
That's right.
To follow up a little bit on what Trish was talking about in terms of, you know, the challenges, was doing this at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center a decision? First of all, I assume you've worked with them before. And secondly, are there particular advantages you see in reaching your mission by going there as opposed to finding a venue downtown?
I think it's the access to the IFCC. Mm. You know, now they can take Max. Everyone knows where it is.
Right.
So there's some comfortability that's built into that. And we've always used the IFCC for a majority of our projects. And so people know that we're there and know that they can come and see a good show.
Mm-hmm.
As far as with the outreach and the whole bit, you know, the support that we get from the from some of the business people from the business community has been really, really great for us, as well as some audiences. But you know, it's always a challenge to keep getting mm-hmm. people in.
Right.
You know, you have to pound the pavement.
That's right.
And you have to, you know, keep hammering home that this is going on and you really need to come see. You have to offer some incentives to get them in there.
Right.
So with this economy the way it is, arts organizations all over the country are having some deep, tough issues, mm-hmm. you know, and some have even gone under.
Oh, yes.
because the mm-hmm. funding is not there.
That's right.
Another thing about IFCC, Dave, that I thought was worth mentioning is that they've got a wonderful art gallery as part mm-hmm. of the facility.
Right.
And they exhibit all kinds of incredible multicultural artists' work.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a there's that tie-in with the community as well. And the more things that they do, and they do have a serious multicultural mission there, so that it's a wonderful gathering place for people from all different kinds of cultures to meet and compare what their cultures have to offer versus other cultures and to meld that artistic sensitivity
right.
at the same time. So it's lovely to be able to have a live theater component mm. to that community meeting place as well.
And so I'm curious, does Passing Art have like a season pass? Like, so can you, do you know what you're going to do for the whole season and then you promote it together? Or do you promote just like individual plays as you decide that you're going to produce those?
Well, again, as we get more people into the theater and get more support, then we add on, continue to add shows on to it. We do have our Reader's Theater component that we're working on now that will be something every month, you know, where people can come and still be entertained, because, you know, it's, there's a difference to sit in the audience and hear someone read till you can close your eyes and imagine that you're there, and then seeing it on stage actually unfolding before your eyes.
That's
so there's the two different dynamics that go along with that.
I ask that because I used to be on the list for Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center and used to be involved in helping with fundraisers and receptions, and it seems like I've been dropped out of the loop.
Well, that's an excellent reason for you to come to the show and sign up for the marriage.
Exactly. Because I'm feeling like left out. Like, well, how come I didn't know all this was going on?
Well, you're invited to the party.
Excellent. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Dave Moth and Joanne Bowman of Voices from the Edge. And we're talking this morning with Trish Egan, Kenneth Dembo, and Jerry Foster of Passenart, who are putting on a production of A Sunbeam at the IFCC. It's a play regarding a family torn apart by problems too big to solve on their own. And we're also speaking with Danette C. Birchall, a clinical associate director of OHSU's Abel Gordley Center for Healing. It's an interesting partnering going on between the two that the center will be providing, will be there present during talkback sessions following some of the performances to help people think about how they address these issues as well as give them some reference and resources. So, and that's going to be happening, and the play opens on April 2nd. If you want to join us in this conversation that we've been having, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And also remember that there's a question out there that can you name what service is participating, and I've pretty much given this away already, but what service is participating in this play, the social service is participating in this play, and if so, you could be eligible for a free ticket. We're giving away six free tickets to the performance, courtesy of Passenart. And by the way, that is PASSINART, if you're trying to get to their website, passenart.com. Kenneth.
Yes.
As an actor, you know, I'm curious, you know, theater... The public school system is gutting the arts, and less kids are having an opportunity to take drama classes. Are you seeing a impact in terms of young people wanting to get involved in theater? Is, you know, are we depleting our next wave of stage actors?
I think it's interesting because, being when I started in theater many, many moons ago, part of the reason why I started it is because I had went and saw a play in high school.
Uh-huh.
And that relationship. And when I was there watching it, I knew then that's what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to be on stage. And years ago, when I was doing live theater, you didn't do shows without having that school relationship. There were always morning performances, especially with ISCC. So those dollars are gone now. So, I think it's impacting the young people immensely. They're having to go to different venues. I mean, they can't necessarily get that training ground in the schools, but there are other resources that they can do. And that's what's interesting about being an actor, is because they're going to get a chance to do what we've always done. We've always strategically come up with ways to do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've always, I've always done theater. Mm-hmm. I've always had an opportunity to do it. Mm-hmm. And if I can't have that relationship with the school districts per se, then how else, then I have to come up with other ways. How do I go about doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that means volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
That means sometimes doing it for free.
We all have to do that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't know any actor pretty much in Portland that hasn't done something for free.
Right.
And we do it because we love it. We can't think of anything else we would rather be doing to feed our souls.
And as far as a community issue, it is in many ways the part of theater artists to help train the storytellers of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we think of it as such or not, there is a need in every culture for the person who puts together all of the stories of the time and passes them along, mm-hmm. whether it's to school friends or family or et cetera, mm-hmm. to keep the conversations going about the issues that are important to our society.
Right.
And acting is one of the ways in which those storytellers work their work and the way they tell their stories. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty important for us to make sure that that ability goes on.
Well, we're going to go to the phone lines because we have a caller. And if you want to join us in this conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We're talking to members of Passanart about a Sunbeam, as well as with Danette Birchall of the Abel Gordley Center for Healing, which is participating in a unique way in this production. And let's go to the line where we have Jeff.
Dave, you just gave it away again. It's the Abel Gordley Center for Good Health that is going to be involved.
I'm checking your listening comprehension skills.
That's right. And saying, how many times can we repeat it before you pick up the phone and call us and tell us what it is?
And thanks so much. And by the way, Abel Gordley's son, Tyrone, has been featured before in various issues and is right out there with mental health issues and is really as a neighbor of mine here in North Portland.
Mm.
And I admire his efforts and his mother's efforts so very much. Mm. And I wanted to say also, I believe Due North is now showing at the IFCC, the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center there at Willamette Boulevard and Interstate, with the all of the North, Northeast local artists, many of whom just do not sell. They create, produce, and so forth, but they're not professionals, but they're neighborhood folks, and it's extremely multicultural. It's always fun. It's our annual Due North, D-O, North at IFCC. And I guess I should...
Is that a commercial? Is that what you're trying to do here, Jeff?
No.
Not so subtly.
It's a great place for the community to get together.
I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll check in later for my ticket. I'm so excited.
Well, right. Excellent. Well, thank you for the call. Have a fabulous day.
Okay. And again, if you want to join in and get one of the five remaining tickets that are available, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And we're asking you to provide the name of the social service.
No, we already did that one.
We did one.
Yeah,
we
can't do that one again.
Well, I'm waiting for Joanne to come up with a second question.
So if people had been paying attention, they would know when opening day of this play is. And so we'd like to know when it starts and when it will conclude.
Oh, okay. There we go. So 503-231-8187 if you want to join us in the conversation and if you want a shot at one of five remaining tickets to A Sunbeam.
And I know Dave won't give that one away again.
I will try to avoid it. Yes, I'm bad about that. Danette, one of the things Trish was just talking about was that theaters, developing storytellers in our community, it's all about communication. And I assume that, that's not always something that's talked about within circles within your profession in terms of thinking of theater that way, but it really does in a way make sense. I mean, most people probably wouldn't have that come to mind, would they?
Absolutely.
You're okay.
You're fine.
Okay, I can't hear myself anymore. I was thinking about the interface between theater, drama, acting, and mental health and therapy. Because there are actually some forms of therapy considered psychodrama where the theater process and the acting process is used therapeutically and in a way of achieving a catharsis or a new understanding about the issues that someone is experiencing.
We don't necessarily conduct psychodrama within our center. We're more of a cognitive behavioral approach around looking at thoughts, feelings and behaviors and our choices, and that's not the only approach that we use within the clinic, but there is a process of communication and catharsis that comes out with theater that can be very therapeutic, both for the audience and for the actors, I would imagine. So I think there is a natural interface of that communication. Mm-hmm. A part of the conversation we were having as a group before we went on air is the idea of being at live theater. the three dimensionality of being in the presence of people acting through a story and acting out the emotions right in front of you, and how different that is from viewing something on television or in a movie where there is a distance, where it's more two dimensional,
mm-hmm.
and how you can actually feel emotions coming from the actors,
right.
and how powerful that is and how cathartic that can be, what a release that can be emotionally for the audience. So I think that community theater is a very personal and emotional experience that can be quite therapeutic for mental health.
And Trish, I mean, before we came on the air, you were in fact talking about your own, you know, observations and experiences, not only being personally drained from performing in a piece that's very mm-hmm. emotionally fraught, but then looking out and seeing in the audience, basically.
Absolutely. There can be tremendously powerful identification on the part of the audience members with the people who are telling the story on the stage. I've been involved in a production before that dealt with a very emotionally charged issue, and that was the first time that we realized that there could be a real benefit from having someone there to help guide audience members through the most immediate storm of their emotions because of the subjects that were being discussed. So we're looking forward to having the talkbacks happening after several of these performances so that audience members and members of the professional community and from the Avril Gordley Center to be able to discuss some of these issues and have a sounding board
mm-hmm.
in a safe area, a safe
mm-hmm.
creative space where yeah. they can talk about their reactions to the play and ways in which that's affected them.
Wonderful.
No, we're going to ask folks, though, if they want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-817. And now Richard raises his hand. Okay, we are going to go back to the phone lines. And we're obviously going to talk to a live person instead of a beeping noise. But if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We're talking with the members of Passanart about the production of A Sunbeam, as well as with Danette Burchill of the Avail Gordley Center for Healing about the sort of unique alliance going on around this production. So let's go back to the phone lines. Good morning. You're on the air.
Are you talking to me?
Yes,
I am.
You are.
Talking to you. You're on the air.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Yes. Well, I was just calling to inquire of Mr. Dembo how hard it was to play a mentally challenged person.
Actually, it's really difficult because there's a fine line of not coming off as a caricature of how do I embody him without playing him how I think he should be played.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, in Saul's world, this is quite normal to him. He lives this life every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the message that I have to get across to the audience,
mm-hmm.
that I have to be Saul. I can't act like I'm thinking like Saul would think. It's like I have to be Saul. So and I think the interesting thing about this production that I didn't have last time is that it's hitting very close to home now,
mm-hmm.
because I have a nephew
mm-hmm.
that's autistic. So now I have an identification. So there are resources for me to draw on. But he's a wonderful character to play too. And that's getting back to how art really works in therapy, because there's a part in the show that they're talking about how speech, that he they're using music and things that deals with the arts that soothes him.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, really, really is important.
Mm-hmm. It's allowed him to become better able to communicate with other people. And I think that Ken really does a wonderful job of finding that fine line between looking as if we're in some way making fun of the character,
mm-hmm.
and
oh right, we want to do that,
right? Mm-hmm. And we want to make him be an accurate representation. One of the things that I think is very common with some categories of developmental disability is that these people have a tremendous, simple, childlike ability to look at the good things in life,
right. mm-hmm.
and to utterly embrace a sense of joy and discovery in everything that they do.
Right.
And Ken's really done a fabulous job of doing that, so that when I'm sitting observing the rehearsal, it's difficult for me not to burst out in laughter,
mm-hmm.
Because he's just such a joyous person. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are lots of times in the production where humor is used as a way to diffuse tension, right, or to try and examine a sensitive subject in a way that serious discussion can't do. So we don't want to leave the impression that this is one of those really serious, right, productions. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of laughs in this play as well.
Okay, well, thank you, caller. And I gather, thank caller, you didn't want to try to answer the question to get a free ticket?
I already told him it's April 3rd to 25th.
Oh, okay. Well,
all
great.
Right. We got another one. Excellent.
Two down, four to go.
That's right.
Well, and by the way, we did get a note from Richard saying someone had called in saying, how do they pick up their tickets? And am I correct, Jerry, in saying that they will be at Will Call at IFCC, so they just need to go down on the day of the performance? Is that?
That is correct for those who won their tickets. That is correct.
Do they need to call in advance or
and pick a date?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they do. And they'll come through. You come through KBOO Radio.
Okay.
You guys, the show.
All right.
And you let us know who they are and give us that information, and it'll be waiting for them when they come.
All right.
And for those who want to pick up tickets for the show anyway, you can go online to boxofficetickets.com. Or you can go to Pass and Art and click on tickets, and it'll take you there. And there are advanced ticket prices there. So there are some discounts that are available online for you. And you can also go to Reflections Coffee and Talking Drum Bookstore to pick up your tickets, too.
And we should say, you know, the general admission on this is incredibly reasonable.
Yes.
I mean, compared to many theaters' productions, $20 is really quite remarkably low. It's a great value. We're going to go back to the phone lines in just a second here, but before we do that, we're going to let you know what's coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, the guest is economist Ravi Batra, talking about the future and the economic meltdown. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, journalist John Ross discusses the hype about the drug trade in Mexico, and Malik Rahim discusses the violence of poverty in the U.S., At 11, on Between the Covers, writer Ian Lee discusses her first novel, The Vagrants. And at 11:30, Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project talks about saving trees in eastern Oregon. All that and more coming up on KBOO. So
you zoomed through that list.
Well, I was trying to get through
so that we
could say goodbye to Danette, who has another meeting to get to, but unfortunately she slipped out while I was yammering on.
But, you know, Dave, I wanted to go back to something you talked about earlier, which was asking about just how do kids get interested in the arts. I mean, and quite frankly, all the creative fields, we seem to have, as a community, just kind of disconnected kids from it, like they have to find it on their own. When I was a kid, you know, they would take classes to the theater, you know. There would be Sunday matinees that would be just about, you know, high school kids or middle school kids being able to go and experience the theater. The same with music and live music acts and performers.
Right.
And today we've just kind of, if you can afford to be involved in the arts, then you are. We need to fix that. So how do we fix that? How do we get more kids exposed to the arts? Because I agree. I mean, this is otherwise we would end up not having the kind of diversity in the arts and music and all the creative fields. Because if you're not exposed to it, it doesn't just happen.
And that's a really relevant point. In the actor part of my life in the arts, it's incredibly challenging and difficult sometimes to be able to find cast members for a play,
right,
or actors to work in a film who are in any of the multicultural ethnic,
right,
sort of categories,
right,
because it's not an inherent part of their upbringing.
That's right.
To participate in live arts of this kind.
Right.
So we think it's really important that if every parent or significant older person could take their younger nephew or
right,
grandson or whatever to see a live play.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of theater companies in town who specifically do children's theater,
mm-hmm,
so the productions are more accessible and more sort of lighthearted and
right,
easier for young kids to identify with.
Mm-hmm.
Both Oregon Children's Theater and Northwest Children's Theater have wonderful childhood training programs.
Right.
And there are lots of opportunities there and in other theaters around town when kids get into their their teens mm-hmm. to do volunteer work, right. to taste what it's like to work in a theater mm-hmm. without the responsibility of having it for a paid job,
that's right.
and to figure out if that's something that they're interested in pursuing. Mm-hmm. We really encourage the activity and the participation of young theatergoers in order to be able to see if that's a lifestyle that they could tolerate, because mm-hmm. it's never an easy one.
No.
But once you're bitten by the bug, it's pretty hard not to do.
Mm-hmm. But also, too, there are other aspects in theater that they can get involved in, like the technical lighting, mm-hmm. the sound, the backstage, the house management,
costume design,
the stage hand, stage help. One of the things that Passing Art has done is work with, is have some student interns mm-hmm. that work on our productions.
Right.
And they have actually gained some kind of knowledge into it, because once you see the play, there's a lot of, once you see the play, the job is pretty much over. But there's a lot of things that happen before that play is put on, you know.
Right.
And a lot of people don't see that aspect of it. And so we give them an opportunity to go backstage and to look at that.
Behind the scenes.
And they'll say, well, I want to do this. I want to do lighting instead, you know, instead of getting on stage.
Right. And I think I want to add to that also is parents, really listen to your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Really find out if they're tapping into that. And also, I would encourage you, as you're getting information with these different venues, different organizations, go beyond the box office.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to the artistic directors. Mm-hmm. Speak to the directors or something like that, and find out when the talkbacks are.
Mm-hmm.
And bring your kids to that, because that's their opportunity to speak to the actors,
right.
to speak to all of the individuals that were a part of that production, and really get a feel for this is what it takes. I would really encourage you to do that.
Well, we're going to go back to the phone line, since we've had a caller waiting here for a few minutes. And if you want to join us in the conversation in the last 10 minutes we have here, talking with the members of Passing Art about their upcoming production of A Sunbeam, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So let's go to the phone lines. You're on the air, caller.
At the Center for Healing, is there anybody there that can answer a question?
I'm sorry, she's actually left.
She had to leave early, so you just missed her by a few minutes. But
we did get her phone number.
So let's give you that.
And that number is 503-418-5311.
Okay.
Some years back, I wanted to get involved in psychodrama as far as mental health issues are concerned. And because I guess I didn't belong to this therapist, one of her patients who I guess had good insurance and money, I couldn't be part of it. So you know what? Classism again. Here it is, classism. Nobody does anything about it.
Okay. Well, thank you for that observation.
Let's see. So another question before we, in our last 9 minutes that we have with you this morning, would be, tell us, what production company is actually presenting A Sunbeam?
Oh, you're pitching them way too.
503-231-818. Well, I want them to be able to win, you know?
We want them to be able to come.
We want them to come, right? So don't you dare give it away again.
I will stop talking. You're on your own for this.
So 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And what we want to know is, A Sunbeam, as you know, is going to start on April 2nd, running through April 25th. April 2nd is community night, where community members who can't afford to have the regular ticket price will be able to see the production at a reduced rate. Opening night is on April 3rd. There will be talkback sessions with the Avell Gordley Center for Healing. And it sounds like this is going to be just a fabulous, fabulous event. It also sounds like that this is an issue. This play deals with issues that are family issues. So even though it's from an African-American perspective, I don't think anyone is assuming it's an African-American play. It's about families and how families interact with the issues that families are stressed with on a day-to-day basis. Was that an accurate assessment?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
See all the heads going up and down? Cool.
Yes.
Also, too, to clarify, on the talkback sessions will happen April 13th and 20th. 5th at after the 3 p.m. matinee.
Oh.
So that's on April 18th and April 25th, Saturday matinee, 3 p.m. matinee.
Okay, got it. All right, so that's important for folks to know, yeah, because I've been telling them, just come and check out the talkbacks. Okay, so, and we will make sure to add that information to Voices from the Edge website. So that listeners will be able to connect to your website to get that information.
Great.
I just want to say that I just think that this is pretty fabulous. I love the mission of Passing Arts. I think it's a fabulous, you have a fabulous focus, and you're really tapping into issues that, as you say, people just don't want to talk about in day-to-day life. But if we don't talk about them, then we never come to conclusions. We never actually solve these problems that really impacts people's quality of life in our community. So thank you so much. So can you give us a taste of what's coming next? And I know this one's about to start, but, you know, you must be excited.
You're thinking about the next production, right?
What's their appetite?
Watch
go ahead.
The newspapers.
PassingArt.net. So he has been sworn to secrecy, and he's not going to tell us. I see those smiles. It's like, I know they know.
That's right.
Just don't want to tell us. All right.
We wanted an exclusive.
It's
here.
All good. That's right.
Well, if that's an open invitation to come back, then we will definitely do that.
We'll just have to bring it back, and then you'll have to tell us again what's coming up, and I don't have any problem with that at all.
And you have to be at the studio again at 7:45.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of pain involved.
But you've been such wonderful guests that we really don't mind that unholy hour of the morning. Joanne, I just wanted to pick up real quickly on what you were saying about this not being something that's specific to the African American community.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a really interesting experience for me as a Caucasian to be able to step into this world and hear a lot of things about the perspective specifically of African Americans when it comes to issues of mental health.
Right.
And the differences are much greater than the similarities are much greater than the differences are. And it's a similarly risky decision to talk about things that are sensitive or taboo and to try and make the decision to look for help. In the play, the mother looks for help with several people that she knows, including the reverend of her church, but doesn't know or isn't able to reach out to professionals who might be able to help her in that regard. So that tenderness, that the frightening aspect of being able to reveal a sensitive what you feel is a lack, which of course it isn't. We all have issues that we need to have someone help us out with through our lives. So please don't anybody think that this is an African, with big quotes, an African American play. It does have African American actors, but the issues are universal.
Excellent. Well, and I was, when Danette was speaking earlier, and she was talking about just kind of some of the stigmas that's associated with seeking mental health treatment. I certainly agree that that's like it's kind of universal. But growing up African American, it's like I certainly can remember like kind of the terminology that people would use. Sister Ann is just she's a little slow, and it's okay, right? And it's like and as a kid you think, what the heck are they talking about,
right?
She seems to be moving fine. And so it was just a whole lot of code words for, we don't talk about that, right?
Nervous breakdown.
It's like, I know, and as a kid, you think, how do you break down? How does somebody's nerves break down? There was all these code words for not actually confronting the fact that, someone's having mental health issues and they need to be addressed. And so I think we've come a long way since that time period, but we still have a long, long way to go.
Sure, people still have feelings of guilt as if it's their fault.
Right.
Mothers with their children.
That's right.
With their wives, all of those kinds of situations, it's as if they could have done something to make it not happen.
Right. If I had done something different, if I had cooked different food,
if I had watched more closely.
That's right. And the last point that I really want to make sure that we just reiterate again is that kids need to be exposed to the arts.
Exactly.
Right? And this is one venue, but we need to, as a community, make sure that we're exposing kids, because otherwise the next generation will lack the kind of artistic talent that this generation has enjoyed and taken for granted.
And volunteer. You know, exactly. you may not have the dollars to spend to go see a play, but you volunteer. There are some trade-offs.
That's right.
So those opportunities are always available.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just contact your local arts group and inquire about what it take for you to become a part of that.
Sure, and there are volunteer usher positions at most of the theaters in town where you can get to see the show at no charge if you come and help, you know, show people where their seats are.
And we're always looking for volunteers. So,
absolutely.
You know,
wonderful.
Always.
We couldn't function without them.
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, we want to thank Trish Egan, Jerry Foster, and Kenneth Dembo, who are with the Pass and Art Production Theater Company. They're going to be putting on A Sunbeam April 2nd through April 25th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center. And I think we've mentioned a number of times that if you're interested in finding out more about the performances, you can go to passinart.com. We'll also be putting all of our all the material on our website, kboo.fm/voicesfromtheedge, so you can get it there as well. We also wanted to thank Danette Burchill, who had to leave a little early. She's the Clinical Associate Director of OHSU's Abel Gordley Center for Healing. And for those of you, we still have a few free tickets left. If you call into the KBOO main desk and answer the question, there's three free tickets left. And that'll be a ticket at will call, and you'll be able to go see the production, and it's going to be well worth it. And one more thing we need to add is coming April 11th, Joanne and I will be interviewing live at the Baghdad Theater Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, who's going to be in town to promote her new edition of Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. You can go to the KBOO website to find out more about that or give us a call here at the station. It will be, I'm sure, a lively conversation with someone that we all value greatly here, as you all know.
So, and, of course, it's a fundraiser for KBOO.
Well,
and so that's a very cool thing.
I was going to shake them down once they got there.
Oh, it's one of those don't ask, don't tell things.
So, I'm Dave Mazza.
I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you've been listening to Voices from the Edge.
See you next week.
I know.
You are so bad.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the earth. You don't know what life is really worth. It's an art that deserves gold. After the story has never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you will look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Yeah, yeah.
Stand up for your rights.
Gonna stand up for
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you better
get up, stand up
in the
gave up the fight.
Good morning to Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, March 26th. You're listening to KBOO FM Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up now, Press Watch. And then stay tuned for Ravi Batra talking about the future and the economic meltdown. Stay tuned for now for Press Watch.
It's 9:03. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Press Watch is a counter-propaganda and left opinion program. I'm Teresa Mitchell with the news you're not supposed to know. Global warming debunkers are coming out of their bunker, their debunker bunker, and they're going to Congress today. And so before they said a thing, I thought I'd point out just what a great growth industry they're a part of. According to Carl Burkhart, quoting Environmental Defense, $450 million was spent on lobbying and political contributions by opponents of global warming action in 2008. 52 public spokespersons were engaged by polluting corporations to spread disinformation about global warming online and in the media. 2,340 paid lobbyists were working in Washington on climate change in 2008. Of them, 2,047 were advocating against climate change, and $45 million was spent on global warming denial advertising by the coal industry alone in 2008. So, you know, they've really got something going on there. And it's all lies. Last week I pointed out on this program that the U.S. response to economic collapse was likely to be a violent and repressive one. That conclusion is obvious by dint of history and the militaristic composition of our society. The economic and social forces that led to the Katrina pogrom are still in place. The lion's share of the financial recovery efforts have gone to the hyper-greed class to prop up the same derivatives avalanche that created the problem. The question I bring now is, what preparations for general repression are already in place? The anti-immigrant hysteria promoted by the corporate media and right-wing politicians has provided a convenient framework for the building and expansion of concentration camps. Currently, there are tens of thousands of individuals kept behind barbed wire right here in the U.S., and that, of course, is on top of the more than 2 million chained in our infamously brutal prison system. According to David A. Love, J.D., writing on this month's Black Commentator, quote, "It was no accident that the United States became the nation with the world's largest prison population, with 2.3 million behind bars and a total of 7.3 million in jail, prison, parole, or probation, or one in every 31 adults. America, with 5% of the world's population, incarcerates 25% of the world's prisoners, and the majority of these are people of color. The most ruthless and repressive totalitarian dictatorship cannot claim such impressive statistics. People, we got to face it. We live in a police state." And David A. Love writes, "Public policy informed by a legacy of Jim Crow racism, the profit motive, and obscene misplaced priorities explains it all." End quote. The excuse for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement concentration camps, which hold families with children, is that illegal immigration is dangerous. But what is more dangerous than a police state? What do we have to protect us against a police state? According to a publication this week by Amnesty International, Jailed Without Justice, Immigration Detention in the USA, these facts. In the last decade, the number of immigrants in detention has tripled from 10,000 in 96 to over 30,000 in 2008, and this number is likely to increase even further in 2009. U.S. detains asylum seekers, survivors of torture and human trafficking. We detain lawful permanent residents and the parents of U.S. citizen children. Immigrants can be detained for months or years without any form of meaningful, individualized review of whether their detention is necessary. The vast majority of people in immigration detention, 84%, are unable to obtain the legal assistance necessary to present viable claims in an adversarial and complex court process. And departing from the text of the Amnesty International report, what kind of nation does that? I mean, just how nasty are we? Maybe that's what it all comes down to. Maybe that's the news you're not supposed to know. We're nasty. My God, what the hell? Anyway, returning to the Amnesty report, the U.S. contracts with approximately 350 state and county criminal jails to house approximately 67% of all immigrants in detention. Detention facilities are required to comply with ICE detention standards. That's the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. However, these standards are not legally binding, and oversight and accountability for abuse or neglect in detention is almost non-existent, leading to practices in violation of international standards. Immigrants are often put in excessive restraints, including handcuffs, belly chains, and leg restraints, and are detained alongside individuals incarcerated for criminal offenses. Individuals in detention find it very difficult to get timely and at times any treatment for their medical needs. 74 people have died while in immigration detention over the past 5 years. That's the now departing from that report, the Amnesty report also details cruel fines and bonds demanded from would-be immigrants, sometimes up to $80,000. These are people who have come here in much the same manner as the families of most U.S. citizens, and who among us can guarantee that all of our ancestors had legal status on setting foot on this continent? The true reason for the detention camps is terror. It's impossible to capture and retain every illegal or quasi-legal immigrant in this country, even if the so-called in-game program states that as its goal. The concentration camps serve the purpose of further deflating wages by giving every employer or other oppressor a tool to frighten the workforce. It's true that most of the people in the camps right now speak Spanish as their principal language. It only takes a turn of the key to change that situation. How would you like to find yourself in some distant hellhole in belly chains, denied legal access and medical care? Your chance may be coming. And your offense? You're listening to me. ICE concentration camps are being expanded, and the purpose for their expansion has been left intentionally vague. Michael Chusadovsky, writing on the Canadian website globalresearch.ca, points out that the economic crisis may already have its American-style solution. He asks, what is the way out? How will the U.S. government face an impending social catastrophe? The solution is to curb social unrest. The chosen avenue, inherited from the outgoing Bush administration, is the reinforcement of the Homeland Security apparatus and the militarization of civilian state institutions. The outgoing administration has laid the groundwork. Various pieces of anti-terrorist legislation, including the Patriot Acts and presidential directives, have been put in place since 2001, largely using the pretext of the global war on terrorism. Directly related to the issue of curbing social unrest, cohesive systems of detention camps are also envisaged. Under the jurisdiction of the Department of Homeland Security and the Pentagon, a bill entitled the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act, that's H.R. 645, if you want to look it up, was introduced in the U.S. Congress in January. It calls for the establishment of six national emergency centers in major regions in the U.S. to be located on existing military installations. The stated purpose of the National Emergency Centers is to provide temporary housing, medical, and humanitarian assistance to individuals and families dislocated due to an emergency or major disaster. In actuality, what we are dealing with are FEMA internment camps. This is Michael Chusadovsky. I never knew how to pronounce that, actually. Writing in globalresearch.ca. That's one of those sites that you can sometimes have some difficulty in pulling up, but it's worth a try. He writes, H.R. 645 states that the camps can be used to meet other appropriate needs as determined by the Secretary of Homeland Security. There has been virtually no press coverage of H.R. 645. These civilian facilities on U.S. military bases are to be established in cooperation with U.S. military, modeled on Guantanamo. What we are dealing with is a militarization of FEMA internment facilities. And that's Federal Emergency Management. Once a person is arrested and interned in an FEMA camp located on a military base, that person would, in all likelihood, under a national emergency, fall under the de facto jurisdiction of the military. Civilian justice and law enforcement, including habeas corpus, would no longer apply. I would depart from the text right there. Now, that's not constitutional. And the Constitution, as I have often commented, does not have a provision for its suspension. The Constitution is now in effect only to the extent that you and I are willing to insist on it. And when I say insist, I mean to the death. That's how we got it in the first place. And that's the only way we can retain our rights. First Amendment rights, right of free speech, right to petition the government peacefully. Fourth Amendment, right not to be searched without a warrant, specifically naming what's to be searched and who's to be searched. Ninth Amendment rights, all the rights that are not enumerated in the Constitution are still yours. Did you know you had those rights? Bill of Rights, look it up. Returning to the article by Chusadovsky, the proposed internment camps, should be seen in relation to the broader process of militarization of civilian institutions. The construction of internment camps predates the introduction of H.R. 645 in January 2009. There are, according to various and unconfirmed reports, some 800 FEMA prison camps in different regions of the U.S. Moreover, since the 1980s, the U.S. military has developed tactics, techniques, and procedures to suppress civilian dissent to be used in the eventuality of mass protests. And Chesedowski quotes the U.S. Army Field Manual 19-15. In early 2006, tax revenues were allocated to building modern internment camp, internment camp facilities. In January 2006, Kellogg Brown and Root, which at the time was a subsidiary of Halliburton, received $385 million in a contract from the Department of Homeland Security's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Contract, which is effective immediately, as of January 2006, provides for the establishing temporary detention and processing capabilities to augment existing ICE detention and removal operations program facilities in the event of an emergency influx of immigrants in the U.S. or to support the rapid development of new programs. Or to support the rapid development of new programs. Or to support the rapid development of new programs. That's the catch. The contract may also provide migrant detention support to other U.S. government organizations in the event of an immigration emergency, as well as the development of a plan to react to a national emergency, such as a natural disaster. So departing from that text, you can see how the enforcement of immigration, the terroristic and partial enforcement of immigration, is hand in glove with the terroristic enforcement against dissent, which is looming and may be put into action at any moment. And I certainly, as many commentators have noted, it would only take another bomb. It would only take another so-called terrorist event, a false flag event, or even an event that's not a false flag that would work as an excuse under these programs to lock up everyone that the U.S. government isn't comfortable with. Does that include you? Does that include anyone you know? Do you care? Returning to that article, the stated objectives of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE, are to protect national security and uphold public safety by targeting criminal networks and terrorist organizations that seek to exploit the vulnerabilities in our immigration system and our financial networks along our border at federal facilities and elsewhere in order to do harm to the United States. The end result is a safer, more secure America. And that's from the ICE homepage. The U.S. media is mum on the issue of the internment camps on U.S. soil. While casually acknowledging the multimillion-dollar contract granted to Halliburton subsidiary, the news reports largely focused their attention on possible cost overruns. A little diversion there, similar to those which occurred with KBR in Iraq. What is the political intent and purpose of these camps? The potential use of these internment facilities to detain American citizens under a martial law situation are not an object of media debate or discussion. Chesedowski writes, in the last months of the Bush administration, prior to the November 2008 presidential elections, the Department of Defense ordered the recall of the 3rd Infantry's 1st Brigade Combat Team from Iraq. The relocation of a combat unit from the war theater to the domestic front is an integral part of the Homeland Security agenda. The BCT was assigned to assist in law enforcement activities within the U.S. The BCT combat unit was attached to the U.S. Army North, the Army's component of U.S. Northern Command, U.S. NORTHCOM. The 1st BCT and other combat units would be called upon to perform specific military functions in the case of civil unrest. The 1st BCT soldiers will also learn how to use the first ever non-lethal package that the Army has fielded, according to the commander, Colonel Roger Clotier. And he said, referring to crowd and traffic control equipment, as well as non-lethal weaponry. Under the proposed withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq under the Obama administration, one expects that other combat units will be brought home from the war theater and reassigned in the U.S. The evolving national security scenario is characterized by a mesh of civilian and military institutions. And departing from the text, I think that's significant. That's one of those things that makes it all sort of blur in your mind. You don't suddenly see a bunch of soldiers show up in your town unexpectedly, standing out. No, the local police are involved in this. The National Guard's involved in this sort of thing. I looked out my window just yesterday about 11 o'clock a.m. and saw what looked like a Huey. It was that type of helicopter, Army green, sliding doors open, flying over Foster Road at treetop level. Well, just a little above treetop level, which is good for not getting yourself tangled in the power wires. And I've seen many such helicopters over the past year, and you have to wonder what the hell is going on. Well, you get used to it after a while. Oh, there's another helicopter. We don't need any Army helicopters flying over Portland for any reason, for any legitimate reason I can possibly think of. We don't have any law enforcement problems that are so severe that we need the military to show up with helicopters. There's something else going on. So I'm asking you, pay attention. Don't put it out of your mind. Don't say it's normal. There's nothing normal about this. Returning to the article by Chistodovsky, the FEMA internment camps are part of the continuity of government, which would be put in place in case of martial law. The internment camps are intended to protect the government against its citizens by locking up protesters as well as political activists who might challenge the legitimacy of the administration's national security, economic, or military agenda. Related to the issue of internment and mass protests, how will data on American citizens be collected, you might ask? How will individuals across America be categorized? What are the criteria of the Department of Homeland Security? Answering that in a 2004 report of the Homeland Security Council entitled Planning Scenarios Pertaining to the Defense of the Homeland, the following categories of potential conspirators were identified: foreign Islamic terrorists, domestic radical groups, that would be anti-war and civil rights groups, state-sponsored adversaries, that would be rogue states or unstable nations, or disgruntled employees, that would be labor and union activists. Departing from the text again, are you a disgruntled employee? Are you an anti-war activist? The quote is domestic radical groups, but you know they're talking about anti-war and civil rights groups. Returning to that article, in June of last year, the Bush administration issued a National Security Presidential Directive, that's NSPD 59, entitled Biometrics for Identification and Screening to Enhance National Security. Adopted without public debate or congressional approval, its relevant procedures are far-reaching. They are related to this issue of civil unrest. They are also part of the logic behind the establishment of FEMA internment camps under H.R. 645. NSPD 59, Biometrics for Identification and Screening to Enhance National Security, goes far beyond the narrow issue of biometric identification. It recommends the collection and storage of associated biographic information, meaning information on the private lives of U.S. citizens in minute detail, all of which will be accomplished within the law. Now, departing from this text again, within the law, remember the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is the law. It supersedes presidential directives. If presidential directives are in contrast to the Constitution, the Constitution trumps it, unless you don't care, unless you're not looking, unless you've forgotten what the Fourth Amendment is about. Returning to the article, the contextual data that accompanies biometric data includes information on date and place of birth, citizenship, current address, address history, current employment, and employment history, current phone numbers, phone number history, use of government services, tax filings. Other contextual data may include bank account, credit card histories, plus criminal database records on a local, state, and federal level. The database could include legal judgments or other public records documenting involvement in legal disputes, child custody records, and marriage or divorce records. The directive uses 9/11 and the global war on terrorism as an all-encompassing justification to wage a witch hunt against dissenting citizens, establishing at the same time an atmosphere of fear and intimidation across the land. Departing from this text again, this has not changed. Maybe it's going to change. Not if we don't call for it. Yes, we have the Obama administration now, but this directive has not been scotched. Returning to the article, it also calls for the integration of various data banks as well as interagency cooperation and the sharing of information with a view to eventually centralizing information on American citizens. So that's how they're going to collect the information to round you up. And going back to what I was saying at the top of the hour, we rounded up a hell of a lot of people in this place. This is a police state. It cannot be otherwise defined. We cannot say that America is not a police state and then look at the millions upon millions of people that we have incarcerated in the jail system, prison system, parole system. That would be an absurdity. So, and you might ask, how is it that in a police state, I can get on the radio and say this sort of thing? Well, the answer is marginalization. I can be marginalized, and I can be threatened with and subjected to arbitrary arrest. And that's how it's done. I haven't been arrested lately, but that doesn't mean I won't be. I haven't been taken into a detention camp, but the detention camps are in place. How about you? Feel safe? The only way you could possibly feel safer is to organize for your human rights, for your constitutional rights, and to be loud and consistent in your organization and in your statements to people around you that you're not going to be a part of a police state. And there's a lot of things that we have to do to turn it around. There's a hell of a lot of people, frankly, that we just have to let out of jail. Don't be afraid. Most of them aren't violent. Most of the people in jail are not violent. And a great number of the people we have in jail, we have there for usage or trafficking in drugs, creating a situation of violence across the globe that could be very easily solved by simply legalizing the drugs. You know, some drugs are just horrible, aren't they? They're awful. They tear people apart. And how many years has it been since Nixon started the war on drugs? We've been losing that war for 40 years now, getting on for 30, 40 years. And how absurd is that? How pointless, how venal, how violent. If we care about people, if we have drug laws for the sake of helping people, then we have to take a look at them and say, they aren't helping people, let's get rid of them. And there are a lot of people who feel threatened by that because that would mean that their paradigm of self-repression has been challenged and that all those people out there somewhere who might actually enjoy a drug would be able to enjoy it without being punished. That's the real basis. That's the fuel for the war on drugs, and it is entirely irrational. If we want peace, if we want a sane, peaceful society, we have to get rid of the war on drugs. I should think that would be obvious. I guess it's not. Well, adding to that information, there's an article on Nathan. There's an article by Nathan Coe on Guerrilla News Network. He writes, memos and legislation aside, one of the more disturbing developments in the emerging and already present American police state is the deployment of troops as of October 1st of last year on American soil with the express purpose of quelling domestic revolt. And here again, I'm talking about the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team, which Nathan Coe writes is now deployed within the United States. They had spent 35 of the previous 60 months in Iraq patrolling in full battle rattle, according to Gina Cavallaro of the Army Times. As the Army Times initially reported, the new mission marks the first time an active unit has been given a dedicated assignment to NORTHCOM, a joint command established in 2002 to provide command and control for federal homeland defense efforts and coordinate, I'm sure they mean, defense support of civil authorities. As Bill Van Auken reports, for the first time ever, the U.S. military is deploying an active regular duty Army combat unit for full-time use inside the United States to deal with, quote, emergencies, including potential civil unrest, end quote. Spencer Sue and Ann Scott Tyson of the Washington Post report that the U.S. military expects to have 20,000 uniformed troops inside the U.S. by 2011 under the guise of assisting state and local officials responding to a nuclear terrorist attack or other domestic catastrophe, and that's according to Pentagon officials. So departing from that article, here's that paradigm again in which the troops are assisting state and local officials. The police state's going to come straight out of your local police department. And what I mean, see, I'm used to saying it's going to come. It might get here. No, we're there. This is a police state. And this is where it's being projected. And, you know, the fact that the police in this town, in your town, in every town, are not prosecuted for killing people randomly, killing people at whim, has everything to do with this police state. That's the guarantee that you give soldiers. It is the guarantee that is continually given to soldiers, whether it's kept or not, is a different matter. Soldiers are told when they're going into the combat theater that they will not be prosecuted for whatever they do. And that's so that when you have your soldier go out there, they're not inhibited, they're not worrying, they don't hesitate, they just kill, kill, kill. That's what you want them to do, I suppose, if you're promoting imperial war. Well, imperial war has come full circle. Now we're the Indians, as the phrase famously goes. Returning to the article, the provision granted the president The president was granted sweeping new powers under a new provision to impose martial law by declaring a public emergency for virtually any reason, allowing him to deploy troops anywhere in the U.S. and take control of state-based National Guard units without the consent of state governors in order to suppress public disorder. What qualifies as disorder? Well, I've got some personal experience in that. I remember the May Day 1999 march, peaceful. It had to do with pom-poms and chanting. Pom-poms chanting, walking down the sidewalk, suddenly attacked on a coordinated command by the Portland Police Department. People were beat up. And the excuse was public disorder. Seen that time and time again. That's just one example that sticks out in my mind. Talk about the 2007 Pentagon spending bill and the measure inserted to amend the Posse Comitatus Act. The provision was subsequently repealed by Congress as part of the 2008 military appropriations legislation, but the intent remains. Given the sweeping powers claimed by the White House in the name of the Commander-in-Chief on global war on terror, powers to suspend habeas corpus, carry out wholesale domestic spying, and conduct torture, there is no reason to believe it would respect legal restrictions against the use of military force at home. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO. An announcement before I depart. KBOO needs your help to mail out our monthly listener guide. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. That'll be happening today from 11 a.m. to about 4:30 p.m. Call 231-8032 in this area code for more information or just drop by. Yes, pizza will be involved. And stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. Good morning. This is the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, March 26. Coming up next, the guest is economist Ravi Batra, talking about the future and the economic meltdown. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, journalist John Ross discusses the hype about the drug trade in Mexico, and Malik Rahim discusses the violence of poverty in the United States. At 11 on Between the Covers, writer Yin Lee discusses her first novel, The Vagrants. And at 11:30, Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project talks about saving trees in eastern Oregon. All that on your listener-sponsored radio, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now as Per Fagren's interview with Ravi Batra.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagren, KBOO News and Public Affairs. And our guest is Dr. Ravi Batra, who is an economist, a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, author of many books. The most recent ones are Greenspan's Fraud, The New Golden Age, The Crash of the Millennium, when there's one I have at home, A Myth of Free Trade, and among other books. And he has been writing articles and interviews. And Dr. Batra, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, I read your interview with Truth Out, and it's very interesting. You talked about the wage-productivity gap as sort of the root of the economic problems we're having.
That's right. That's the main cause of almost every economic problem today, but the administration and other economists are focusing their attention on the banking crisis. That's the effect. They are confusing between cause and effect. That's why all the trillions that they have spent on the banking industry and also Wall Street have not stopped the bleeding, they have not stopped this recession. and things will not improve until they pay attention to the wage productivity gap, because the wage productivity gap is a real cause. And what happens because of this gap is that there is overproduction in the economy. That too much supply, not enough demand, and overproduction is much more difficult to tackle than the problem, the financial crisis. And so they're not paying the attention to the right area.
Well, productivity then is usually defined as the amount of stuff, goods, that a worker can produce.
I
know this
that's
is
productivity. On average, how much a worker produces in the economy is productivity, and that productivity is the main source of supply.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever productivity goes up, production or supply of goods and services also rises, but the main source of demand are wages. So for a balanced economy, for an economy to stay healthy, supply has to be equal to demand. You cannot have too much supply and not enough demand, which is what the case we have right now. That's why, for instance, there are too many cars produced in the country, but not many people are buying them. So you have overproduction, and overproduction leads to huge layoffs, as we see right before our eyes. Every month there is a big rise in unemployment. So the cause is that there is extremely high productivity, but wages are stagnant. So as long as this productivity wage gap remains, the recession will not be over. There will be more and more layoffs. Now, should we not pay any attention to the banking crisis? We should. But the focus should be mostly on the wage productivity gap. That is, we have to revive various industries like the auto industry or the housing industry, and we should not be focusing our total attention on the banking crisis.
Well, I know this is a matter of, you know, of a pretty factual record that productivity has been going, you know, they have figures on how much the productivity has gone up in the last, say, 30 or 40 years, and we also know that wages have been essentially flat out since about the 1970s, and so there it is, right there, the facts.
That's right. This problem has been in the making for a very long time, and that's the reason this recession is so deep. We have been postponing this problem by creating more and more debt, either through the government or through the consumer. And now the debt postpones the problem because you can raise demand with the help of all this borrowing. But in the end, debt cannot rise forever. So when debt stops rising, you have a major crash in the economy, and that's where we are right now.
And so if the banks, I mean, the banks have got all kinds of money, which apparently they are just sitting on, and, you know, if nobody wants to borrow money, then what's the good of giving the banks all this money to lend? Nobody wants it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, even if you were to give people interest-free loans, even then they may not borrow money, because starting a business in a downturn is very risky.
You know, one thing, this is a little sidelight here. You know, you mentioned cars, and I have heard, now I'd like to, if you have information on this, I'd really like to know, is that, you know, the U.S. automakers claim that, well, it'll take them, you know, several years before they can start producing, you know, high-mileage cars. But I have heard that the U.S. automakers sell high-mileage cars in Europe. You know, they get, say, 40 or more miles to the gallon. But for some reason, they are not allowed to sell them in the United States. Is that true?
That's right. This is exactly what's wrong with the auto industry. They don't look at the long term. They only look at the short-term profits. And they focus too much on those SUVs. And then we had a major jump in the oil prices, and they couldn't sell them anymore. So that was the start of the problem. If they had maintained a healthy balance between small cars and large cars, they wouldn't be in the current soup as they are.
Is there any reason why they can't just take these cars and sell a few of them here in the United States? Is something stopping them from doing that?
No. Nothing is stopping them, but now demand is down all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not even much demand for small cars in the U.S. So look at what's happening to Toyota and Honda. They produce small cars, and even those are not selling. But the main problem in the end, we come back to this too much supply and not enough demand. And what is the cause of that? Rising productivity, stagnant wages, and total focus on the banking industry. So that's the whole problem with our economy.
Well, another little sidetrack. I just read in the paper recently that the Tata company in India has come out with a $2,000 car.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I saw a picture of it. It's about 10 feet long, and it's, a pretty nice-looking car, and it's supposed to get fantastic gas mileage, and it only costs, apparently, $2,000.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to the wage productivity gap. So what the bosses do then is instead of giving the workers a pay raise, they're sort of giving them credit cards.
That's right. The government is bought out by business interests, and the government is following policies which restrain wages, and this way profits go up sharply. And high profits produce very high stock prices, and that's how so many people got lured into their, they invested their 401k plans in the stock market. But these high profits are supported by debt.
Mm-hmm.
And if debt was not there, profits won't go up because companies have to sell their products before they can make profits. So once debt stops growing, you have profits start to fall and there is a stock market crash. And because of that crash, people have lost almost half of their wealth in their 401k plans. So this is an ugly situation because the government tried to restrain wages through its policies. It was very successful, but now you have a major crash and possibly a depression coming up.
Okay, well, this is Per Fogring, and we are talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, who's a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University. I've been hearing quite a bit lately that, economic voices you hear on the news say that our economy cannot function without credit, without debt. Is that true? Why do we need debt to make the economy run?
Well, our economy used to function very well without debt and credit until we started free trade and cut the income tax sharply while raising taxes on the poor and the middle class. In other words, until we started to follow policies that restrain wages and make the rich richer, we did not need much debt in the economy. But this is the way it is now. And we can go back to the early policies that we had in the 1950s and the 1960s, the two decades when the living standard grew at a very strong pace, at the fastest pace in the United States. If we went back to those policies, which have been already tried, then we can fix our economy very quickly.
Well, they talk about things like a company might need an overnight loan just to meet its payroll. That made me scratch my head. Why does the company have to take out an overnight loan just to make its payroll? They should have, if they're functioning right, they should have enough money set aside for that.
It's very sad these are the companies which are run by small businesses. They are the ones that need credit to meet their payrolls. And look what they did to small businesses. They raised their tax rates so much. It started with Reagan. The small business tax rate, which is a self-employment tax. Self-employment tax has the biggest bite on small businesses. And that tax went up by 66% under Reagan. And ever since then, it has stayed very high. So these small businesses have to pay very high taxes. That's why they need a lot of credit. And they did all this so that they could cut the income taxes for the wealthy. And the, as a result, our economy is very dependent on credit now. And we should not, it should not be like that. You're right. And that's what I have been, that's why I made the forecast. You know, the, we mentioned two of my books, which came out recently, Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age. In both these books, I wrote that within, I mean, Greenspan's Fraud was written in 2005. The New Golden Age was written in 2006. In both of them, I wrote that within 2 years, we are going to see a major economic chaos. That's part of the subtitle of one book. We are going to see a major economic chaos because of the rising wage productivity gap. Then we'll have stock market crashes, major problem of unemployment, houses won't sell, banks would be in crisis, and it would be incredibly hard to come out of it. So I made certain recommendations for various reforms, and I said if we follow these reforms and start closing the wage productivity gap, then we can avoid the coming chaos. But nobody paid attention, and now we are in that soup. So my forecast right now is that with all the focus that they have on the banking industry and not on the major, other major industries, we are moving towards a depression.
Mm. Well, I'd like to talk some more about the new golden age and later on, but, you know, when you write about free trade, this raises a question I've always wondered about, is that it's very interesting. Your writing raises all these fundamental questions. You know, the sort of the explanation for free trade is what they call comparative advantage. You know, one economy is able to grow apples real cheap and the other one grows bananas real cheap, and so they swap apples for bananas. And this is sort of the standard free trade argument. But what happens if one economy grows apples and bananas real cheap and the other one can't match it? What happens then?
That's exactly where we are. And we can't match it, so our living standard has to come down. And we can't match it simply because our wages are higher than other places. Now, the question is it desirable to have lower wages just because we want free trade? No. Of course not. Why should we reduce our living standard so that we have free trade? The purpose of economic policy is to raise people's living standard, not to reduce it, and so that's the problem.
So what do we do with all this debt that we have now? I just read that the Federal Reserve is buying something like $300 billion of Treasury debt. Now, what does that mean?
It's going to create a lot of inflation in the long run. They still want to maintain the status quo, and in the process, they're going to wreck the economy.
So what they're doing then is they're adding $300 billion, to the economy, and which sort of...
No extra production.
Uh-huh.
And so there is increase, there won't be extra production, and most of this increase in demand will go to foreign goods. So what good is it?
So we can expect a lot of inflation... any time now, I suppose.
Well, not any time. I'm more worried about a major depression than inflation at this time. But in the long run, yes, we could have major inflation.
So what do we do with all this debt? Is there any way to get out from under it? How do we deal with this?
You mean the foreign debt or the...
Well, I guess if you combine all the debts, the government debt, business debt, consumer debt, I mean, they add up to trillions and trillions of dollars. What happens to it?
They do add up to trillions and trillions of dollars. So...
How do we...
Foreign debt is not that much of a problem. It's the domestic debt. The fact that the American consumer is maxed out in debt, that's the main problem.
Okay.
And so we need to eliminate our trade deficit first.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminating the trade deficit would revive manufacturing in America, and then slowly we increase the minimum wage to close the wage productivity gap. First, we eliminate the trade deficit and also focus on the auto industry, like you could give a 20% tax credit to buy a car. And buy a car made in America.
Mm-hmm.
So people start buying U.S.-made cars. Then we increase employment in our auto industry. And as things start to revive, then slowly raise the minimum wage to close the wage productivity gap. As the minimum wage goes up, all other wages will also rise, and then consumers will start to buy American goods. Once this happens, banks will not need any rescue.
Mm-hmm. What about, now I've been hearing some people talk about government banks. Now, North Dakota has a state bank, and I guess what it can do, it can issue its own bonds, you know, for projects and things like that. Is that a good thing to do?
If it has its own bank, this is okay. They don't have to borrow money in the financial markets. They have they're using the funds from the public, and I'm sure it's insured by FDIC. So that's fine. I think that's a good idea for various states to do that.
Because apparently, you know, the way things are now, well, here in Oregon, you know, when there's something that needs to be funded, you know, the state of Oregon, I guess, well, they wind up paying interest to the banks to float these big bond issues, where in North Dakota with a state bank, they wouldn't have to do that. They can just issue their own. It's almost like issuing your own currency.
Well, it's similar to that, but I think this is actually not a bad idea for states to open their own banks, because they can use the funds in much better ways than what these big banks do. They simply finance takeovers. You know, so much of bank lending has been done to finance takeovers, and takeovers simply create more layoffs. And as there are more layoffs, there are pressure on wages. Wages don't rise while productivity keeps rising. So actually, that's a good idea for states to open some banks of their own, to create some competition with these big banks.
So tell us about now this latest book you've written, the New Golden Age. Can you tell us some more about that?
Well, I wrote this book in 2006, and I predicted that because the government policy was simply to create more debt in the economy to postpone the problems of overproduction, pretty soon there will be a major banking crisis, because this debt has been rising for almost 30 years nonstop. So I predicted that there will be major economic chaos, and because of that chaos, the public would want big changes in politics. So they will throw out many politicians who are responsible for this mess. And so I predicted that a man like Obama would be elected, and this was in 2006, remember. A man like Obama would be elected to bring about change, but change won't be that easy because you have to elect a new person, but also change ideas. And ideas don't change as fast. So I predicted that this major economic chaos will continue till at least 2010, maybe 2012. And then people would be so fed up from all these problems that there will be a major revolution, and the rule of money would end in our society. To me, today's capitalism, or capitalism in general, has meant the rule of money in society. So once the rule of money is gone, then the economy will revive at a tremendous rate, and we will have a new golden age, an unprecedented golden age. So my tone in the book is very optimistic, except that I think until about 2012, we have major economic problems.
Well, so what will replace the rule of money?
The rule of money would be replaced by economic democracy.
Uh-huh.
See, if you have economic, like right now we have political democracy, and see how many, what is the average wage of a politician? Like the president earns about $400,000 a year, and other congressmen, etc., earn about $200,000. We don't have wages like that. They are paid to CEOs and like millions and billions of dollars because there is political democracy. Once we have economic democracy, wages will rise in proportion to productivity. That's the only way to stabilize this economy in the long run. I'm talking about the long run changes. Otherwise, if productivity rises and wages don't, we are not going to come out of this recession and even depression. So in the long run, we have to have economic democracy where the management is responsible to the employees. Employees will then elect the board of directors, and board of directors will appoint their executives. But these executive wages will not rise while other wages are stagnant. So when productivity goes up, everybody's wages will have to rise, and that will end the wage-productivity gap and therefore solve our problems. So in the long run, I foresee economic democracy replacing the current monopoly capitalism.
Do you think this will be a more decentralized economy?
Definitely. Right now we have real dictatorship in various companies. When a CEO can reward himself bonuses and wages even when they are dependent on the government, it shows they are so arrogant and they think they can do anything. So we have kind of dictatorship in the economy, but in the long run, factories will be run democratically, and there will be a new golden age after that.
Well, you know, they call themselves the masters of the universe, so maybe we should bring them down to earth again.
Right.
Well, I mean, and how do you think this will come about? You talk about a revolution. I mean, how would it happen? Would it happen through the ballot box?
Through the ballot box, they will overthrow our current politicians and demand changes in the economy and society.
Mm-hmm.
So that will, it will all happen through the ballot box. It will happen only because there is economic chaos. And once the politicians want to be reelected, and when President Obama finds that his current policies are not working, then he would look for new ideas. And those new ideas mean the end of the status quo, the end of the Wall Street barons, and huge bonuses, and the end of the economy running on credit and foreign money and so on.
Well, right now, of course, the status quo is all the money. They sort of fund the elections, and they have most of the media, you know. I mean, we're just a little small radio station here that's paid for by the people who listen to it. This is quite a struggle to be up against the people with all the money.
Yeah, it's a struggle, the things will change. Unfortunately, it takes a major economic downturn to bring about revolutionary change, but I'm not surprised this is happening because poverty results when you follow policies, that expand the wage productivity gap. There is increasing poverty and unemployment, and in the end, those who are responsible for those kind of policies are thrown out. And that's what I'm predicting is going to happen in the next 4 to 5 years.
Okay. You know, one last question. When people talk about, things we need to do to, get the economy going again, and even, the Republicans talk about all the debt and everything, I don't hear much talk about what does our military budget do? We spend $500 billion every year on the military, if not more. I mean, what does that do to an economy?
Unfortunately, our military budget is only going to rise. I have made a forecast in the New Golden Age also that terrorism is going to spread in the world, and that will mean military budget is only going to rise. And that leaves less for other programs, healthcare, education, and so on. So we are facing a huge mess pretty soon. And a lot of it is the creation of George W. Bush and his kind, the Reagan and his dad and so on. Clinton is also responsible because he signed for NAFTA, and NAFTA, after NAFTA, our productivity went up sharply, but wages fell even more.
Mm.
So all these politicians have been sold out to big money and big business. And so in the new gold, people will realize that, and they will not elect people, they will not elect politicians who raise a lot of money. Money will be a negative in the future elections.
Okay, I think we'll end it there. We've been talking to Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University and author of many books. The latest is The Golden Age. Do you have a website where people can contact you or read more?
Oh, that's right. I have a website. It's very simple, ravibatra.com. And my name is spelled RAVIBATRA.com, ravibatra.com. And I have my latest articles on it and a lot of stuff on it now. I'm writing regularly now.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ravi Batra. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay. Coming up is Air Cascadia, and then our Flashpoints. Let me say, Flashpoints is going to interview journalist John Ross about what's going on in Mexico. John Ross has been here at KBOO several times, and he is really worth staying tuned for. So stay tuned to KBOO for Air Cascadia and Flashpoints and beyond. Thank you very much.